Have you thought about how everyone in your family, and even your extended family, would be affected if someone died? At the Martin Funeral Home, they are prepared to help the entire family through these life changes. No doubt, the death of a loved one is devastating, and the grieving process varies from person to person. All death-related business matters are handled personally by a member of the Martin family, either Ross or his son Tom Martin. For personal preference at a funeral home, let the Martin Funeral Home handle everything. The Martin Funeral Home, located on Center Avenue in Butler.
Oh, we do have a lot of sunshine today. I was just talking to Pat Parker here, and I said, who would have thought it's like 90 degrees today, right? It's September 25th, and we're going to maybe hit 90. They're calling for 89, so we'll see how high we go. Some clear skies tonight with the low down to 63, and more sunshine tomorrow with a high back up to 88. Pretty close to the same on Wednesday with sunshine and a high of 86. Thursday, some sunshine, a high near 69. It'll be on Friday that we stay in the 60s at 67. Saturday, 64. 82 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Year Bank Studios. Next Year Bank, your hometown community bank. Your news time is 12:31. And, of course, you can always hear us on Alexa-powered devices. Download that skill and then just say, Alexa, what's in the news? Dave Malarkey's up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks for joining us, and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome to the Monday edition of It's Your Turn. Dave Malarkey is my name. It's a book talk day, and we have a really, really good book to talk about, and it's nonfiction. It's true story. Also, later on the program today, we continue our series of chatting with just sit-down chats with top administrators from area school districts. We thought it would be a good time to review that. And we've already talked with several, and on the agenda today for a chat is Eric Richard, who is the superintendent in the Carnes City Area School District. But that'll be later on the program today. Our first guest with us here in the studio is Jill Hambly. She is the director of the Prospect Community Library. Jill, it's good to see you again. Nice to have you back with us.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Can you pull your chair just a touch closer to that mic for me? That's grand. Okay,
all
make
right.
Sure my engineer says that's loud enough. Is that good? Okay, good. We last talked. It's amazing to me. I go back and I look at our schedule here. I can't believe that it was just before Christmas the last time we talked.
Well, it was the last time we talked about the book. I was here at the beginning of the summer with XTO Energy discussing the PBS Inquire Within grant.
That's right. No wonder I couldn't believe it when I looked at that and said, December. That's the last time I saw Jill Hampley. December. That's right. You. By the way, how's that going with the Inquire Within?
It's going fantastic. Within? And yeah? XTO Energy is now sponsoring two other libraries in Butler County. Butler Library and Butler Library.
We just talked with the folks at South Butler a couple of weeks ago about them initiating their program.
So. Yeah, so everything's going great. We're glad to have support from the companies around the county.
Well, the mystery is solved. I feel a lot better now that I just straightened that out. By the way, the book that we talked about last, it was right before Christmas. It was just a few days before Christmas.
Yeah.
It was about gaming, right? Ready Player One.
It was Ready Player One, and the movie is set to come out this coming March. So I loved that book. I know you didn't like it as much as I did, but I really did enjoy it. I look forward to the movie.
Well, you have family members who are really into it.
My son is a sophomore over at RIT.
He would be into it. He better be into it if that's where he's going to school.
So he better enjoy it.
Well, the book that we're going to discuss today is called The Killers of the Flower Moon by David DeGran. That's the title, Killers of the Flower Moon. The subtitle is The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. I got to tell you, as soon as this book was delivered to me, Jill, and I saw the title, I said, I'm going to like this because I have a little bit of an interest in Native American Indians and culture. I did not know much at all about the Osage. I didn't know anything about the Osage, for that matter. And The Birth of the FBI, that sounded interesting. That's been in the news all over the place. So I said, this is going to be a pretty good read. And it turned out to be just that.
Yeah, it was. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad you did. I knew you had said you enjoyed reading about history. And in college, I actually took many, many history classes. So, you know, I actually enjoy reading about history, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything about this time period. So it was a book that I thought we could both enjoy.
Well, this is a classic case of how poorly treated the Native American Indians were. And this is not an isolated case, this particular tribe, the Osage tribe. This happened with the Seminoles. It happened with the Creek Indians, some of the Northern Plains Indians, where they would be pushed onto a reservation. And then westward expansion by white settlers would push them. They'd push them somewhere else. Then they'd make them up and move again to somewhere else. They kept giving them what they thought was the most worthless land in the world. And they made them live on a reservation, too.
Right, right. A lot of white people at the time didn't even consider the Indians to be people. They were savages in every way to some of the white community at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, the founders of the country, the writers of the Constitution, looked at African Americans the same way. They were considered 3/5 of a person.
Right.
In the original U.S. Constitution. It was amended later, but they were only considered 3/5 of a person.
And, you know, you wouldn't want to be considered 3/5 of a person any more than I would, any more than an American Indian or an African American or anybody out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us, talk a little bit about the structure of this book. It's really divided into, I guess you'd say, three different parts, right?
Right.
There's the story of the Indians. And then there's the story of the FBI investigating these horrible murders. And then there's kind of a middle part, too, kind of connects the two.
Right, right. And the first part, the Indian part, is told from the point of view of Molly, who was central to the murders because of who she was married to. She was married to a white man who was the nephew of a very powerful person in the community. And it was central to why these murders were being committed and how they were being committed.
Yeah, this was the bad guy of the whole story. So we'll get to him momentarily, that's for sure. Tell us a little bit about the basic plot here, because that's how it starts out. And we need to know about the Osage. They were, first of all, shuttled off their original lands. And this
Right. Many, many times. Think Trail of Tears. You know, they were marched across how many miles, how many states to this part of Oklahoma and told that's where they had to stay because the hierarchy at the time thought that it was the most worthless piece of land around.
And, you know, some of our biggest founding father heroes were involved here.
Yes.
A delegation of Osage went to see Thomas Jefferson.
They did because it was during the Louisiana Purchase, you know, that a lot of this occurred.
He bought part of their land. Well, it was, I forget the acreage. It's like 100,000. It's huge.
Right.
Part of their ancestral territory that Jefferson bought, not from them, but from the French.
Right, right, because the Indians weren't seen as having value and they couldn't actually own something because they were savages, so how could they own that land?
So they sent a delegation to see Jefferson in Washington, and he promised them in so many words, we understand, and you'll be treated fairly, you know, all men are created equal,
mm-hmm.
blah, blah, blah. And, well, that didn't happen. They were moved around, and they ended up in Kansas, which was not their final destination. It would, by the way, there's a convenient map right in the end cover of the book. It was an area of Kansas that was right next to the Oklahoma border, just north of the Oklahoma border. And this was going to be their final reservation. Here you are. Here you go. And then, of course, the white people came, and that turned out to be good farmland. And once again, they moved. And this was to what we now know as Osage County, Oklahoma.
Right.
Just over the border. There was a little bit of a secret here because this particular territory was just looked horrible. There was nothing growing there. It was dirt. It was dry. It was hot.
It was unlivable.
It was unlivable. And the Indians said, well, we'll buy. That's why actually they bought this land.
Right, which is key to how everything came about.
Mm-hmm, because they knew that there was oil under there and nobody else knew it. And they ended up granting leases and they became extremely wealthy.
Right, billionaires by today's standards, mm-hmm. Really. They lived very high on the hog. They had cars, and they could afford education for their kids. And there was a lot of money out there, except that if they were more than half Indian, they were forced to have guardians.
Yeah. Competency role.
Right.
amazing. By the way, the time frame for this is early 1900s, whenever...
When it started.
Yeah, and this is when the Osage who lived there, and mostly they lived in kind of oil boom towns, actually, little villages within Osage County. And this would have been in the early 1900s, just to put a time frame on it. So that's early 20th century. And they became very rich very quickly. It wasn't over a long period of time. They became, many of them, just instant millionaires.
Right, and there was one part in the book that kind of made me chuckle a little, because who even today wouldn't react in a similar fashion? The story was how if the tire on their car went flat, instead of fixing the tire, they'd buy a whole new car, mm-hmm. because that's how much money they had.
They had servants who took care of the menial tasks. There was one line in the book, I don't remember the exact quote, but it was, even white people were doing these menial tasks for these Indians. Can you imagine?
I know. Can you imagine?
Yeah,
like, that's
yeah.
how much money was floating around.
So what happens when you get that much money in a relatively small space? The bad guys start to drift in. You get crooks, gamblers, all kinds of people.
Swindlers.
Swindlers, yeah. Swindlers is the key word, because this goes to the fact that the federal government still, we had Indian Affairs Office. You know, we got to take care of these people because they're not competent.
Correct.
You know,
they're Indians or savages.
Yeah, they really don't know what they're doing.
They have the intelligence of a
3-year-old. They've got a lot of money, but they don't know how to handle it. So they had the competency testing, and it was minors had to have a guardian appointed by the federal government, and as you said, was it half?
It was. It seemed to come out that if the person involved was at least half American Indian, that the courts automatically gave them a guardian.
Now, the problem is, that sounds like, okay, we would never do that today, but what was wrong with it back then? A lot of these guardians were swindlers. They were
right.
cheating them out of life
of
and
everything.
Home.
Everything.
Yeah, everything, really.
Right, and towards the end of the book, I did like the statistics that the author gave about how many Indians died under some of these guardians. Like, the guardians obviously were in it for the money, mm-hmm. and, you know, they did whatever they could to get a hold of the money.
Well, there was another way that these swindlers operated, and this gets more to the meat and potatoes of our story, because the first part of the book is really told from the standpoint of Molly Burkhart, who is Osage. She's full-blooded Osage Indian. She has three sisters, I believe. There's four of them all together.
I think.
Yeah.
She has a big one.
And their mother's still alive at the time.
At the beginning, she's still alive.
Yeah. Her mother was Lizzie. Her sisters were Anna and Minnie. Yeah.
Minnie, I forgot about
Minnie. Yeah, yeah. And what was...
Rita.
Rita, that's right. Okay, I'm sorry, I forgot that one. Well, there's a lot of names here. And these are real people, by the way. They They really existed. These are not made-up names. So you could, if you were a swindler, for example, here we have these four daughters, all full-blooded Osage, all richer than you could possibly imagine because they had secured the mineral rights to the, you know, the grounds under their reservation.
Right.
And there were white guys who married them.
There were.
Yeah.
There was a white guy that married Molly.
Married Molly. Ernest, forget his last name. He was a nephew of the real
Burkhart.
Bad guy. Burkhart. Oh, yeah, of course, Burkhart. What am I thinking?
He was a nephew. He was a nephew of Hale, who is also a key figure in the story.
Yeah, he's the real bad guy, William Hale.
He's the boss hog from Dukes of Hazzard. That's all I could think of.
Good
he's
analogy.
He's the non-funny version of boss hog.
So Molly marries Ernest. And, well, you know, when I read about what was happening here with these Native American Indians, these Osage women marrying white men, my first reaction was, why? Why were they doing this? Weren't there any eligible males in the tribe that they could have... the question is, in some cases, they were... They fell in love with these guys. These guys were, especially Ernest, he was described as extremely good-looking, very suave and sophisticated, and he really rolled out his game for Molly, and she fell for him.
Well, and... I'm sure for at least some of them, marrying a white guy would give their children more legitimacy in society because of how white people at the time viewed American Indians.
I guess. Yes, if they were ridiculed in the papers, you know. Even white people are doing their menial tasks for them. Okay, I didn't think about it from that standpoint. But all of the... Lizzie's daughters ended up marrying or going with white guys. And they were all bad guys. they were all swindlers.
It makes it a little sad to think about, like, that time period. Like, where were the good guys? I'm sure they were there. And as the second portion of the book shows with the person who was in charge of the investigation, he was very much a good guy, so it was good to see that there were still some good people around.
So what happens, again, the first part of the book is told from Molly's point of view. She's already married. She has a couple of kids, I think, at this point.
I think she has two children. She ends up having a third down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But the book doesn't talk a whole lot about her children. It's definitely much more about the adults and what the adults are doing.
The problem is that one of the sisters, Minnie, was the first one to die. She was only 27.
Right.
And the official cause of death was listed as a mysterious wasting disease.
Yes, mysterious, absolutely
mysterious. And Molly was, even early on was suspicious because her sister Minnie was 27. Today we would consider that young. Back then it was the prime of your life. She's dead all of a sudden at 27. Wasting disease? What the heck is that?
Right.
Okay. And then a few years later, Anna is found dead. That's
right.
the another sister.
And during this, too, there's her mom, who's also seems to have this mysterious wasting disease.
Lizzie.
So they're not spread out. These deaths are not spread out. They seem that way when you're first reading the book, that first section, the way it jumps around so much, it makes it confusing. It makes it seem like these murders are going on across like 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
But like the bulk of these murders were pretty close together. They were only a few years apart.
Yeah, well, I think within about 4 years,
yeah.
Really. So talk a little bit about Anna, because she was... A little bit of a freewheeling
she was. Anna
sister.
Was the wild one. Yeah. She always went out and had fun.
Well, she has already been married and divorced, I think, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, she had been divorced, but she liked to date.
Mm-hmm.
So when she came up murdered, it wasn't so beyond the realm of possibility because she liked to have the kind of fun that she liked to have. She liked to go out and drink, and she liked men.
She drank and she danced, and she liked men. There's a story, and this takes place right as she is killed. Molly seems to be kind of the steady hand in the family.
She does.
She's not the oldest. Anna is actually the favorite of the mom.
Right. By like a year and a half, I think she's, Molly is a year and a half younger.
Mm-hmm. But she's the glue. She keeps everybody together, keeps the family together. And she is having some friends over. I don't remember the exact circumstances to her house. And she already has two young kids.
Right.
And she tells her husband, Ernest, ring up Anna and see if she can come over and help out. Oh, I know. They're caring for the mother, too, Lizzie,
right.
who's in poor health.
She needed help.
Yeah, needed help to care for her. And, you know, I got these guests coming over. See if Anna can come over and, you know, help out, watch the kids or whatever. And Anna comes over and she's bombed, you know.
Yeah.
She's drunk at that hour of the morning and creates a scene among the guests. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, she creates a scene, which isn't, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, that's Anna.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody, even today, knows somebody that is a little like Anna.
Pulls out a flask in front of the guest, takes a couple of slugs, and gets totally bombed, and starts flirting with another of the family of William Hale. Ernest is Hale's nephew.
Right.
I can't remember the guy's name. It's another one of the men, the young men.
Right.
They had
what I mean, though. Like, at that beginning, it all kind of came together at the end, but at the beginning, there were so many names being thrown out, it was a little difficult to remember who was.
Well, they had dated at one time, Anna and this other...
I think it was Brian.
Brian. And they had dated at one time, and she's getting drunk and making a scene, and he says, well, you know, lots of other women in the world, and she issues a threat. She says, if I ever find out you're going out with somebody else, I'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a line that, as soon as I read it, of course, I knew already what had happened to, what would happen to Anna, and it stuck out in my mind. It was the end of the day, the end of the festivities. It was a luncheon or something. I don't know what it was. And most of the guests went off. Well, they went off to see a show somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And a live stage show or something. And Molly was going to clean up Anna and send her home.
Right.
And she, because she was a mess, you know, so she washed her clothes, sent her home, and was never seen again.
Right.
Never seen again. She, Brian said, don't worry, I'll drop her off at home.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that took her in his car.
Right.
And a couple of days later, nobody had heard from her. A week later, nobody had heard from her. 2 weeks later, and by this time, Molly obviously is extremely suspicious, although she doesn't necessarily think she's dead. You know,
because she's a wanderer. And
once in a while,
she
takes off and goes to Oklahoma City on a binge, you know.
Right, and they didn't have cell phones. It's not like today where we're so connected that even if you're that far away, you can still get in touch. You know, they're 2 weeks. You know, Anna was known to go out and have fun, so it wasn't so uncommon.
However, after a couple of weeks, there's a guy who's out fishing with his young son.
Oh, yeah.
And the little boy discovers the body in a ravine.
Right.
And
that's a sight he'll never forget.
Yeah. By the way, it's pretty graphic, some of the details of these killings.
Yeah.
Pretty graphic descriptions. Turns out she was shot in the head, execution style.
She was. And then, of course, they have to do the autopsy, and they never did find the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
But the two more key characters come in, which are the brothers, who are the doctors, who do part of one of the autopsies, because she's actually autopsied more than once.
There's another death, well-known... full-blooded Osage by the name of Charles. Why do I check my notes here? Charles Whitehorn. Also, about the same time as Anna's body is found.
They were found pretty close together.
Yeah.
And he was also shot.
He had also been shot. So that's three, at least. And then, lo and behold, Lizzie dies, the mother.
Right, from that wasting, that mysterious wasting disease.
Cause of death, mysterious wasting disease. I mean, this is not like back in the 1700s. This is in the 1920s that this happened. You know?
Right. And they have money, so they should have access to good doctors for that time period.
And then there's another sister, Rita. She's one that dies in a fire, right?
With her husband, Bill. Yeah. The house gets blown up.
Oh, that's right. Nitroglycerin.
Mm-hmm. Along with one of their, of course, they had an Indian helper, but with their helper.
So you begin to think that even the authorities
should see
are going to say, can we connect a few dots here? These Native American Indians, these Osage, were all extremely wealthy. There's a lot of swindlers around. There's a whole bunch of them turning up dead.
Right.
What do you think?
Right. And then the mineral rights, as people are dying, the mineral rights keep getting filtered down through the family, and they're really getting filtered down to one person.
William Hale, the bad guy.
Well, he's having them filtered down to Molly because he has control over his nephew.
Yeah, well, she's married to. And by the way, don't they try to poison her too, but she lives, right?
She does, because she has diabetes. She legitimately has diabetes. Mm-hmm. And those two brothers who I mentioned with Anna's autopsy, they're supposedly giving her insulin shots, which were new at the time, these insulin shots. But the insulin shots contained poison.
Folks, as I told you, every once in a while you have to pinch yourself that this is not some great fiction novel that David Gran made up. This is all true. This all happened.
Yeah, it does seem very strange as you're reading it, like how they really like poison, the murderers during this time, obviously because whiskey was poisoned, because many, at least 24 Indians were murdered during this time period. Those are the only ones that they actually know about. There are many more that, you know, how many were said to have had that wasting disease or determined to have died some other way, which really was being poisoned. So there's probably more than 24. But yeah, that's a crazy number, and a lot of them were poisoned.
It's a book talk day here on It's Your Turn. And if you've joined us a little bit late, the book that we're discussing is brand new, actually, and just published this year. It's called Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and the Birth of the FBI. And the author is David Gran, G-R-A-N-N. I had not heard of him before. You said he had another pretty big bestseller, The City of Z or something like that?
It sold very well, The City of Z, which is also a nonfiction book. I haven't read that one, though, so I can't really speak about whether it's good or bad or even the topic.
You say this book was flying off the shelves at Prospect Library.
It was in the system, actually, when it first came out. So we always like to see a nonfiction book get circulation like that because, you know, really at the end of a long day, a lot of people just want to pick up the latest Patterson book because it's an easy read. But really, this book, nonfiction, certainly has all the killing and mystery and investigating of any Patterson book.
Our guest is Jill Hambly. Jill is the director of the Prospect Community Library, and she is chosen. She's the one that chose this book for our discussion today. By the way, incredible research by David Gran, the author. In fact, I don't know whether I've ever seen, I don't know, turn to the back here. There's like, I don't know, 50 pages of archives and resources that he said he looked through.
And you would really have to have all the information that's packed into this book and told in a way that it makes it come alive to the person reading it.
He also has photographs of, there's one that I saw, it's of three of the sisters, Molly and Anna and Minnie. They were all very attractive women, you know, for this time period. We're talking about early 19th century now. And the photographs had them all in Native American apparel. They all had Indian blankets and, you know.
They tried to maintain the old culture, but it was hard to maintain a lot of the old culture with a lot of the new wealth that they had coming in.
A great deal of wealth, yeah. So this is Oklahoma. This is a state now. It's not a territory anymore. We're not having the rush of the land rush of the Sooners or anything like that. Did they have any law enforcement out there? I mean, 24 murders on a reservation, doesn't this start to raise a little bit of suspicion? It was all local, wasn't it?
It was all local, and I found it so interesting because when I think of the 1920s, I think of like the flappers and the jazz age and Prohibition, but the law enforcement really had so many vestiges of the old Wild West. Even though it was the 1920s, it was very much like being in the old Wild West with the law of enforcement.
The sheriff in this particular territory or county, whatever the municipality was, his name was Harvey Freeze. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's that was his name. The author, David Gran, doesn't treat him very nicely.
you could very much tell that the author didn't like some of these individuals.
No. He weighed in excess of 300 pounds. Can't you just see him?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, I'm a county sheriff. By jabers.
I say goes.
That's right. Help me move my body around here. And he also had alleged connection with the bootleggers. Do recall, and you alluded to this, Jill, this is the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
Prohibition.
Right.
They weren't allowed to have alcohol in the United States.
They weren't supposed to, but, you know, everybody did. It just, they tried not to keep it so much in the open, you know, because then you could get arrested or, you know, put away for it. But the alcohol definitely still flowed, as the poisonings showed, because a lot of the Indians were killed through their whiskey being poisoned.
Isn't that amazing to think back? I can't imagine. It was about a decade, roughly 1920 to 1930, that Prohibition was in effect, and then it was repealed. But it just
was actually roughly the time of these murders, too.
Yeah, it just seems like, what were these people thinking when they enacted this law? I mean, you talk about asking for criminal activity. We're going to ban alcohol. I mean, it's just like asking you to get punched in the nose. You know there's going to be bootleggers.
Yeah.
You know there's going to be crooks. You know there's going to be organized crime, violence, murders, all because of alcohol.
Yeah, and there certainly was all of that. And in the city, there was more of the mobster-type organizations running the bootlegging. And when you're in the country, you there's a different group. Mobsters weren't really out in the middle of the country, but the sheriffs... even the sheriffs were involved to some degree. Like, everybody wanted their take on everything.
Mm-hmm. Describe a little bit about the... this was an area in Osage County, but there were boom towns that had sprung up with the oil. I don't know how big they were, but... fascinating name. Whiz Bang was the name of one of these boom towns.
That was
towns.
The actual name of the town, yeah.
Yes.
Like, seriously.
Pawhuska was another one. Gray Horse was another one. And these were all boom towns, and they had
everything.
What you were talking about. They had the speakeasies.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the illegal liquor flowed.
Right.
The crime, the dance halls, the prostitution, and all that sort of stuff. These were the areas where Anna
just like the old
frequented before she was murdered, unfortunately. So this sheriff, Harvey Freeze, alleged connection with bootleggers, huge obese man, did absolutely nothing in terms of trying to solve all these murders.
No, because what did he care that some Indians were being killed?
Yeah. So the tribe, the Osage tribe, then asked, I'm going to have to refer to my notes again here, Jill, because there's too many names for me to remember. Barney McBride, who was a trusted oil man, a white oil man.
Mm-hmm.
And the tribe asked him to look at all these dead people. Go to Washington.
He was a private eye, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yes. Well, they sent him to Washington to try to get the federal government to intervene.
Right.
Now, the FBI had been created by Teddy Roosevelt in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
So it had been around for
12 years,
something like
not
that.
Not a whole long.
But it was very small. It was not well organized, at least according to Grant, and I have no reason to doubt his research.
Right. I don't even think they were allowed to make arrests or carry sidearms. Or like, there was a lot of things that they were not allowed to do. They were allowed to do even less than some of the local police departments.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI could investigate, but they didn't have really very much power at all.
And keep in mind, this is the 1920s. This is a very remote area. No cell phones, no communication. They had only a handful of offices around the country. Now every big city has an FBI office. Pittsburgh has an FBI office.
Yeah.
There were only a few hundred agents, and many of them, according to author David Gran, were cozy with criminals back in these days.
Right, because I think they figured that to have somebody working undercover, they needed to be cozy with them to get undercover. However, you know, that didn't always work well.
Well, look at the stories we have from that era with the G-Men, you know, Elliot Ness and all the gang, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was the extent of the federal government. And the tribe asked this Barney McBride. You can't make up these names, by the way.
I know, it seems like an old dime store novel.
These are real people. And I'm laughing because tragically, they sent this guy to Washington, D.C. to try to plead for government intervention. Who was president then? Harding? Was it Harding?
Harding was president during, these murders.
So they send McBride to Washington to plead for help on the part of the tribe. One day after he arrived in the nation's capital, his body was found in a culvert in Maryland.
Yeah, people mysteriously died. Anyone connected to these cases, even if they weren't Indian, they died. If they found too much information, they died. So there were definitely, anyone looking at it could see that there was a link, but it was also scary, you know. If you got involved, you were risking your life.
It wasn't just dead. I mean, they made it. It was just gangland. We want to scare the heck out of you.
Yeah.
His body was found in a culvert, naked, stabbed more than 20 times.
Yes, they were definitely making a point with his murder.
Yeah. So what do? We have more than 24 confirmed Native American deaths. All of them suspicious. We suspect there's a whole lot more than that.
Yeah.
The tribe pleads with this guy to go to Washington to ask for federal help. He's killed one day after he gets there. Here comes J. Edgar Hoover to the rescue. And that kind of leads us into the next part of the book, right?
Yeah. And I didn't know a whole lot about the beginnings of the FBI or Hoover. So it was really interesting to hear. I really liked the part that mentioned that Hoover worked for the Library of Congress and had learned the Dewey Decimal System and how to organize because of working at the library. And that's how the FBI became organized.
Mm-hmm.
Good old fashioned librarianship.
Yes, he was named the head of the FBI in the 1924, somewhere in the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
I was astonished. I had no idea. I mean, I knew he was the head of the FBI for a long time. I had no idea. He was still head of the FBI in the Nixon presidency in the early 70s.
He had a huge influence on the FBI.
My gosh.
The Hoover Building in D.C., you know. He was in charge of the FBI for like a third of the time that the FBI's been around.
Well, he whipped it into shape.
He did. He organized it, that's for sure.
Yeah, because it was pretty frayed whenever he was named the head. By the way, some great pictures of him. I have the image of J. Edgar Hoover, because I came of age. He was still the head of the FBI, but he was a relatively old man by that point.
Mm-hmm.
They have pictures of him as a young man in the 20s when he took over. It was almost unrecognizable.
People change a lot in,
I guess 60, that's 50 years. So tell us what this leads to now, because this leads into, again, listeners, the title of the book, Killers of the Flower Moon, subtitle The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI, because this is really the next whole segment of this book.
Right.
And it leads us to a central character by the name of Tom White.
Right. It leads to his hiring.
Mm-hmm.
And White was working in Texas at the time. He had been through the Texas Rangers. His brothers had been through the Texas Rangers. His father
was a lawman, wasn't he?
His father was a lawman who actually used to bring the younger convicts home to stay at their house with them because he felt they were too young and he didn't want them in with the older, more grizzled convicts. So White had an unusual upbringing, and I think he really learned kindness towards all from his father.
I couldn't help but think of Mueller when I get to this part. What are we going to do? Let's get Tom White.
Yeah, absolutely.
I realize it's
they were at the end. They were at the end of the line there. They didn't know what else to do, and it's a good thing they hired White or got White on the case.
So, tell us a little bit what happened, folks. This is not a mystery novel that we're ruining the surprise for you. This is a true story. This all really happened. What did Tom White do?
Well, first off, he went to D.C. to talk to Hoover because he wasn't sure if he even wanted to take on this case, but Hoover convinced him to do it. So he went to Oklahoma and he gathered a group of agents and people that could go undercover for him so that he could put this case together and solve it.
That's right. I forgot about that. He actually had two guys in particular, I think, that went undercover into the tribe to try to...
Right. Yeah, because there's no better information than what you can get from the inside. A lot of people don't want to talk to lawmen. You know, they want to kind of keep them away, especially if you think everybody connected to the case is going to get murdered. You really don't want to be talking to anybody.
Well, you can imagine at this point, if you're a member of the Osage tribe in, one of these little boom towns all in Osage County, you'd be scared to death. I mean, this wasn't a tremendously large tribe, by the way. Everybody would have known at least some of these people who were shot in the head or mysteriously dead in a period of a short time. You'd be scared to talk. It would be a natural reaction.
And it affected
reaction.
Them for generations. It wasn't just like, oh, it's solved and then it went away. Because not all of them were solved. And it affected generations of these Osage Indians trying to figure out what happened to family members.
So did White's undercover people and his team that he, because he put together a nice team.
He did.
Did they have immediate success?
Not immediate success. There were a lot of roadblocks that went up because Hale had so much power and so much money that he was able to bribe and, frankly, scare people into not working with the FBI.
See some of the pictures of him in the book?
I didn't.
What a piece of work. William Hale. This is a real person, folks. It's one of those people, that when you're watching a movie and as soon as you see him, you say, I know that's the bad guy. This kind of looked like a bad guy.
Yeah, and even just in reading the book, some of the statements that made me so angry because nobody likes it when somebody who's rich just gets their way because they have more money and can pay their way through. Like, nobody likes that, except for the rich person involved.
Just take the one case of his nephew, Ernest Burkhart.
Mm-hmm.
He persuades Ernest to marry Molly.
Yeah, he does.
For no reason at all except to eventually kill her and get her money.
Right.
I mean, my goodness, what kind of a scumbag is that?
Yeah, you're starting from point one off on a bad foot with your wife, that's for sure. But
here's the deal. I want you to go, woo this. She was in her late 20s at the time, I think, maybe around 30. I want you to court and woo this Osage Indian woman and then marry her, and then we'll make sure she dies, and you'll get the mineral rights to the oil that she holds. You'll get all her money.
That's how persuasive Hale was, though. And I don't know what did it for Eric Burkhart, which thing persuaded him more, whether it was family loyalty or whether he was afraid of his uncle. I'm not sure, made it seem like it wasn't the money so much with Eric Burkhart. To me, it seemed more like it was all focused on Hale, and he had to do it because Hale told him to.
We'll take a break. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about this book. It's a pretty good read, folks. By the way, it's a big book, you know. I don't want to say you slog through it. I didn't slog through it, but it's a, you know, it's a read. It's going to take you a few days.
Yeah. I read bits and pieces. It took about a week.
I would agree with you. It's a book that you can do that with. You can read it for a while and set it down and come back a day or so later, and you're still okay. Yeah. We'll take a break and come back and talk more with our guest. Jill Hambly is with us. It's nice to see her again. She's the director of the Prospect Community Library, and we're talking about Killers of the Flower Moon. By the way, remind me when we come back from the break, we've got to talk about where the title comes from. It's a great story there, too. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. Stick around. We'll be back right after these words. Are you back to school ready? At Institute Hill Pharmacy in Butler, our knowledgeable and friendly staff can help you with all of your back to school prescription needs. We carry asthma, allergy, and diabetic medications. And when cold and flu season hits, we offer a variety of over-the-counter medications and speedy prescription fill service to help you feel better fast. So stop by Institute Hill Pharmacy, located at 937 East Jefferson Street. Call 285-3693 or find us on Facebook. A healthy and happy school year begins with Institute Hill Pharmacy, an old-fashioned pharmacy just the way you remember.
I know of a way to reduce the level of future stress in your life, and I know that it works. One of the most stressful times in our lives is immediately after the death of a loved one, because we have to make so many decisions. The funeral, which casket, which minister, priest, or rabbi, cremation, visitations, church service or not, all these decisions. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler suggests that you avoid all these last-minute decisions during that most emotional time by pre-planning. To make all of these decisions now, when you can think clearly and rationally, when you're not burdened by the immediate event. Talk it over soon now with Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Call 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or www.thompson-miller.com. Pre-arrangement. It makes sense. Thompson Miller. Time-honored excellence.
Welcome back, friends. Book Talk on the It's Your Turn program today. We do this every month, by the way. It's almost always on the fourth Monday. Occasionally that has to get shifted because of a holiday, but not often. And we take turns. We go around to the public libraries throughout Butler County. It's the library who selects the book. And this month it's Prospect Community Library with Jill Hambly selecting Killers of the Flower Moon. Let me read. I like to read a couple of sentences anyway.
Sure.
To give listeners an idea of the writing style. And if I can find this again, it explains the title. David Gran, G-R-A-N-N, is the author. And I'll read. In April, millions of tiny flowers spread over the Blackjack Hills of the Osage Territory of Oklahoma. There are Johnny Jump-Ups and Spring Beauties and Little Bluets. The Osage writer, John Joseph Matthews, observed that the galaxy of petals makes it look as if the gods had left confetti. But in May, when coyotes howl beneath an unnervingly large moon, taller plants like spiderworts and black-eyed Susans begin to creep over the tinier blooms, stealing their light and water. The necks of the smaller flowers break, and their petals flutter away, and before long they're buried underground. This is why the Osage Indians refer to May as the time of the flower-killing moon. So, fascinating, huh? And a little bit of insight into Native American culture, too.
Yeah, obviously the Indians are all about nature, great preservers of nature and great observers of nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are, we hear of Native American Indian names for full moons. Here in our region, generally it's the North American or the Eastern Woodland Indians whose names we use. Different tribes in different parts of the country, different cultures in different parts of the world all have their own names for the, you know, the full moons. And you can understand if you lived hundreds of years ago before, you know, all the astronomy knowledge that we have today, why it would be quite common to make names for a full moon.
Yeah, everybody has their own, you know, culture and ideas of why things might happen. And as communities, we all want to know why. Isn't that the ultimate question, the why?
So what happens with Tom White's team? Do they eventually convict anyone of homicide, or do they solve any of these mysterious murders?
They do, which actually surprised me, because I thought it was going to be one of those sad endings that kind of leads you to believe, here's who probably did it, but nothing happened. Mm-hmm. So I was happy to know that Hale was put away and Burkhart was put away for at least some of the crimes. Maybe not for as long as we would have liked or might have been, warranted.
Well, sometimes prosecutors have to, they'd love to charge a person with outright first-degree murder, but they know it's doubtful they're going to prove that. And a lot of this stuff was vague,
Right, it was. I especially found it interesting because Eric Burkhart had confessed, and he was the prime witness against Hale. And then the courts actually allowed the defense attorney to take Eric Hale off the stand and talk to him in private in the middle of this case. That would never, never, ever, at least I would hope it would never happen now. Uh-huh. And that made him change his mind. Like the defense attorney, threatened him. And then all of a sudden, he was no longer a witness for the prosecution.
Can't always trust the courts in this country. We hate to admit that, but we've had kangaroo courts. We've had all white juries in the Deep South back in the day convict African Americans of rape and other crimes when it wasn't true. So sometimes it happens. That's astonishing, though.
Yeah, but I loved how Eric finally, in the end, was like, you know what? No, I'm going to do the right thing. And he did end up being a witness for the prosecution. That made me feel a little better. He did the right thing. And according to the author, he said accounts made it seem like he felt a lot better. Eric felt a lot better once he confessed. And he didn't even care that he got put in prison because at least everybody knew what had happened and he'd unburdened himself. Whereas I don't know if Hale ever would have felt that way, because he had psychological evaluations done, and he seemed like he was probably a little bit of a psychopath.
Yeah, just a pure bad guy.
Yes.
Simple as that. Well, you can imagine tucking your nephew into marrying this woman just so we can kill her. Right. I mean, you can get all of her money.
Right, and his best friend. That was a murder we didn't even talk about. One of his best friends he murdered for $25,000 in insurance money.
Yeah. This guy really existed, folks, this William Hale, H-A-L-E, bad guy. And by the way, I think we mentioned Molly Burkhart survived, even though there was an attempt to poison her. This was the last of the sisters. Mm-hmm. She recovered. She survived. That's good news. You were telling me, just as we were about to go on the air, and I really didn't get to finish the conversation, you've heard rumors that this is going to be made into a movie, did you say?
I did. I just happened to be flipping through my phone to, refresh my memory with some of the stuff that I'd been reading all week for the book. And it said that the movie was in pre-production to come out in 2018.
Oh, so it's already, it's not just a rumor, it's their donut, huh?
Supposedly, I didn't look super in-depth. I wasn't able to read anything else, but the one little blurb I read, that's what it said, pre-production 2018.
Hmm. Well, this would be, if you're talking about, converting books into films, this would seem to be one of the easier ones. I mean, you don't have to do any special effects of outer space or any of that sort of stuff.
It would be a little cheaper to do this one. You just need like old
all takes
West
place
revolvers.
In Oklahoma. Yeah, yeah.
It's a little poison to be
get the right actors, and you're ready to go. Plus, look at the success of some of these films that the early days of the FBI, you know, the Untouchables.
Oh, you're right. Because it's interesting seeing these men, how they all got started, because where the FBI is now, and then you look back on how it got started, and it has come so far. It's really come along.
Well, these, and I did not know this. I mean, I've never studied the history of the FBI. I guess why should I know it? But to think that it was these murders, these two dozen murders, that the FBI existed, but it was nothing like it would turn out to be. It was these murders that shaped the FBI into what it is today.
Yeah, they forced the FBI to get organized. And Hoover, of course, was he was rule-oriented, and he wanted policies and procedures. So it wasn't just the murders. It was definitely Hoover also wanting to make sure everything was organized and establishing rules and regulations for the agents. And he expected them to behave a certain way. He wanted the FBI to be like the college graduate place where agents were knowledgeable and had not just experience, but they had taken the classes and learned what they needed to know to do it in an intellectual manner. Hoover didn't want just any old West guy coming through the FBI shooting everybody up. He wanted there to be rules.
It's made me want to, I don't think I want to read a whole biography of J. Edgar Hoover, but
maybe a short one.
Yeah, maybe do a little bit of background work on his career, because think about this. This guy was the director of the FBI for 50 years through how many presidents? Today, already this year, we've seen the director of the FBI fired at the drop of a hat. Were all these presidents afraid to fire him? Surely they all didn't like him. They couldn't have.
He actually had a room where he stored files of information about other people, about politicians, about anyone in power that I'm sure he used to get his way more than once.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you just think, FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, nobody fired him. They kept him on as director of the FBI.
It makes you wonder, what exactly did he have on all these people?
By the way, and our time begins to run short here, are the Osage still, the Osage tribe, what remains of them, are they still in that little neck of the woods in Oklahoma?
They're still there, only now they have Indian casinos.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think there are 7 Indian casinos. So instead of making money on oil, they used the money that they got from that and the education that they received to put it into another business venture that's made them a lot of money, the casinos.
And I understand there's no oil wells anymore on their property.
Very, very little oil left.
But
there.
Now there are wind farms.
Well, it's wide open prairie.
Yeah. Well, they know the energy business, so why not? You know?
Absolutely. Why not?
By the way, I was looking up, Meryl Streep did a film with Osage in the title. It was like Osage Country or something like that a couple of years ago. I did not see the film. I don't think it had anything to do with the Osage Native Americans. It must have just taken place in this, because this is a real place in Oklahoma.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It might be interesting to watch now, though, that I've read the book.
I don't know. I
can remember pictures of what it is now.
I remember seeing the trailer, and I thought it's very unusual for me not to be at least somewhat interested in a Meryl Streep film.
She's a fabulous actress.
Oh, she's the greatest. But when I saw this, I said, yeah. And I never did end up going to see it. I think it was called August Osage Country or something like that. A strange title. Is that right? Hey, Jill, good to see you again.
It was good to see you, too. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for choosing this book. As I told you, literally when it was delivered here, I picked it up and read the title and said, I think I'm going to like this.
I'm glad that it was a book that we could both enjoy.
Killers of the Flower Moon. We'll warn you, it's a little graphic at times, but it's all true. Killers of the Flower Moon, the Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI by David Gran, G-R-A-N-N. You can find it in libraries and Butler County, and as soon as I give my copy back to Jill, there'll be another one in the Evan City Library, because that's where my copy came from. You can put that on the truck, can't you, for me, and get it back there.
Absolutely, I'll take that with me.
We'll see you next time.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
It'll be sometime next year, because we're getting close to the end already.
Yes, I know. I can't believe that.
More to come on It's Your Turn here on WISR. We're scheduled to chat with the superintendent of schools in the Carson City School District. His name is Eric Ritzert. He's next on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. Stick around. We'll be back in just a moment or so.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? When floodwaters reach your door? When wildfires are engulfing the edge of your neighborhood? Or an earthquake is destroying buildings? When a tornado is tearing through town? Or a hurricane strikes? Or is the best time, perhaps, today? During a disaster, you may not be able to stay in touch with your family or friends as easily as you think. And it's not always as simple as using your cell phone. That's why now is the time to take action. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location downtown Butler to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Welcome back, good friends. It's the Monday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. We thank our earlier guest visiting with us. Always nice to talk about a good book with Jill Hambley from Prospect Community Library. And as you know, over the past few weeks and for the next few weeks to come, we're going to be chatting with top administrators in area school districts around our region. We just thought it was a good time to kind of get a little bit of background information on the schools. It's been a long time since we went around and talked with all the superintendents, so we're in the midst of doing that. And today we're most happy to meet and to chat with Eric Ritzert, who is the superintendent in the Carson City area school district. Mr. Ritzert, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
How long have you been superintendent in Carson City, sir?
I've been the superintendent for the past 6 years.
Oh, that's relatively long tenure, is it not? From what I read, top administrators, not only in school districts but at colleges these days, tend to move around pretty quickly.
Unfortunately, you're probably accurate. I think that I might be one of the longer serving in the same school district in Butler County.
Are you originally from this area, Mr. Ritzert?
I am. I grew up in Butler County, specifically Shakora, so I am a local product and very happy to have put down roots in my community.
Well, you know, I like that. I know there are people who make a case for, outside new blood, and I suppose you could debate that. But gosh, in today's day and age, I think there's a lot to be said for having administrators and teachers, for that matter, who are familiar with the local district. What do you think?
Well, I think there's advantages and there might be even some disadvantages, but most definitely I do understand the demographics of my community. I was a former student of the system that I serve. I taught here. I have administrative experiences in other school district other than Carson City, and I pretty much was born and raised in the area. I worked in private industry briefly and had some time in California and Texas. So, I've move beyond the bubble if it makes sense, but I very much like the local area. I like Butler County.
Tell us a little bit about the Carn City Area School District. First of all, ballpark figure, we don't need an exact number, but roughly what's the student population in all schools in Carn City?
Okay, well, we have approximately just a little over 1,400 students in kindergarten through 12th grade. We have three schools, two elementary buildings. Both are structured as a K through 6 setup. That would be Shakur Elementary School and also Sugar Creek Elementary School, and then our junior senior high school, which is a 7 through 12 building.
So you have followed what has become the seemingly the pattern in terms of consolidation of elementary buildings. I know you used to have at least a few more in Carn City than you do now.
That's correct. When I first started my very first year, it was sort of a difficult year because there was a lot of issues, but a very good year in that we made some choices for our school system that I think were improvements. Unfortunately, we did close the Bruin Elementary School. It had nothing to do with the building nor the school itself. It was just a facet of the declining enrollment and our efforts to try to right-size the system as we navigated the future. And I think it definitely was the right decision. I wish we were talking about growth versus decline, but that's reality for a lot of us in this area.
Oh, absolutely. This is nothing at all against Carn City. My goodness. In fact, the latest statistics that I have seen show only one school district in our entire region that is showing a growth in student population. And by the way, it's not Seneca Valley, it's Mars these days, and that's because of influx mainly of families who are moving across the Allegheny County line into Butler County because of lower taxes. But every other school district is showing at least some decline. Does that reflect negatively on the individual school district? No. It's the demographics. People are waiting a lot later to get married these days, and they're having a lot less kids. Right, Mr. Richard?
I agree with that. I have three myself, and if things were different, may have had more. But I think three is probably, in today's terms, a reasonably large family.
As I recall, there was some consternation in the community about the closing of Bruin Elementary a few years back. Again, that is nothing negative about Carn City. Anytime this happens, I'm sure you're familiar with what the Butler Area School District went through 2 years ago. They closed several elementary schools all at the same time. And it's a tough move to make for the people whose schools are getting closed, but you have to step back and look at the overall view, and you have to look at the future, right?
You do, and it's never easy, and I don't think anybody comes to the position or the problem with the desire to do it. It's based on the reality. And with Bruin Elementary, we had a series of meetings, and there was probably at times upwards of 100 people attend the meetings. Not all agree with the decision, but they at least express themselves appropriately. And honestly, I'd have been disappointed if people wouldn't have been speaking out about the change. But when you present them with the information, the reasons why it's necessary, and also some of the improvements that can be had by being able to spend the resources that you have more effectively on kids, how you're able to help the education that you're able to provide.
Nice.
I think people generally did support it after it was close to being implemented, and definitely to this day, I think everyone probably still sad that the building is closed, but I believe the students have benefited.
Well, especially with the cost of the technology that's needed to keep abreast of things today, whether it's whiteboards, electronic whiteboards, or laptops, or computer labs, the days of being able to afford all that stuff in small neighborhood schools are long gone.
It is. It's a challenge, but on the positive with technology, it's somewhat of an equalizer for smaller and more rural districts to help compete with some of the more suburban type school systems. So it is costly at times, but it is of great benefit to the educational process.
Garden City is, by the way, I have to go back a few years for this. Mr. Richard, I'm sure it was before you were there. I don't know, maybe it was whenever you were a student there. But Garden City is a great success story of merging, and not just consolidating a couple of buildings, but merging a school district, for goodness sakes. East Brady School District ceased to exist and merged into Garden City.
That's true, and I was, believe it or not, a high school chemistry teacher here at the time when those students... came to our building, and again, you know, people may not like the change when you're going through it, but it really was probably one of the best things for the two communities to have happened. And although they were formal rivalries in sports, the students that came to us from the East Brady area have been a tremendous benefit to our system as a whole, and I think that the kids today consider it as their school. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. One more note on this area. I don't want to stay too long on this particular subject, but there's a neighboring school district for you, AC Valley School District, that in one fell swoop closed all of their elementary buildings many, many years ago and moved all of the elementary kids into one new building on the same campus as the junior, senior high school. Boy, you talk about a culture shock for that district.
It would be, but you gain the efficiency of scale of being able to have or operate your school buildings on one campus. You can save money on transportation, plus on staffing. You can more effectively, you know, utilize your staff, because even if they're between the two buildings on one campus, you're not really losing any travel time. So I think the people involved at that time for AC Valley made a good decision for the long-term outlook of their district.
We're talking with Eric Ritzert, listeners, if you're joining us a little bit late, and that happens, especially people getting in the car and turning on the radio. Eric Ritzert is the superintendent in the Garden City Area School District. I understand it appeared from your website, I just gave it a quick glance earlier this morning, that you're looking for input from citizens in the district for the possibility of needing some building renovations. Is that so, Superintendent?
That's true. What we're looking to do is kind of twofold, is to look at the maintenance and upkeep of possibly the existing buildings, but we are also in the initial phases of looking at consolidating the remaining two elementary schools into one building. The enrollment projections into the future, I think, make that a prudent thing to be looking at. And there's the possibility that Sugar Creek Elementary School would be closed and possibly operating our K through 6 or a K through 5 program at the Shakora site.
Mm-hmm.
And if it becomes a K-5, we'd be looking at the junior, senior high school needing a facelift and maybe operating a middle school and a high school model within the physical outlay of the building.
I mentioned that to someone at the radio station this morning because they knew we were going to be talking to you, and somebody said, renovation at the junior, senior high school? Well, I can remember when the old high school building was there. I said, hey, do you realize how long ago that was? That was probably 30 or 40 years ago.
That would have been. I think that the last renovation to the junior, senior high school would have been as a result of the, they put an addition on to accommodate the kids from the East Brady area.
Mm-hmm.
For 1 year, we had all those students in the existing building, and it was crowded. So they had added some classrooms and enhanced the physical outlay of the building. And, we're looking at, that was back in probably 1984, 85 that the renovation was done. So, you know, what people see of the building, they would say, I'm not sure it needs it. But, you know, the mechanical systems, there's upgrades that cost a lot of money that you have to be strategic in how you address them.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Eric Ritzert, superintendent of the Garden City Area School District, any timetable on this, sir, or are you still just looking for input from the public?
Well, it's We're looking for the input, but I would put a timetable on within the next 3 to 5 years. The needs of the buildings coupled with the declining enrollment make it a prime opportunity to look at, can you take the 3 schools and reduce them to at least 2? Or is it economically feasible to get onto one campus and only have 1 or 2 buildings here?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that there are 2 tracks to consider, the educational benefits, but also and probably primarily such the economic costs of which path you take.
Yeah. I'd mentioned AC Valley going to 1 elementary. I forgot Montauk did the same thing. They have just 1 elementary school now, yeah. Have you done any study? I'm sure it was just tragic news to hear about the closure of Indespec, which has now happened. It was rather sudden, and it happened over a period of a few months. Obviously, that has had a great impact on your not only your student population, but your tax base, and perhaps most importantly, on the lives of the people that live within your district, sir.
Well, most definitely. There's you know, nothing will replace probably those jobs. That plant had been there for a long time and employed quite a few of our residents with good high-paying jobs, and that's going to be an economic blow to our community at large and the school system. Plus, coupled with any time a large employer like that is no longer there, the psychological hurdles it creates as well. When I spoke of our potential renovation or building project, we'd started down that path before we were aware of the closure, and obviously I think that has slowed the process up because it's a challenge even when the economy is doing well or fairly well. It's awfully hard when you're dealing with one of your top 3 employers in the area no longer being operational.
We're talking with Eric Richards, superintendent of the Carnes City Area School District. They have about 1,400 students, all told, 1,400 students. That would be at 2 elementary schools, Shikora and Sugar Creek, and also the Carnes City Junior Senior High School, which is right in Carnes City. In addition to declining student population everywhere, and the possibility of job losses, what are some of the other major problems that administrators in school districts face today? Bullying would seem to be something that comes to mind to me. We certainly have had an increased emphasis, well, first of all, an increased realization on this problem and an increased emphasis on it in recent years.
Well, I would agree. It's a problem that affects adolescents, and it could affect adults as well. But as an adult that works with kids, we share the burdens and the responsibilities to ensure that they have a safe and welcoming place to learn so that they can put forth all their energies in acquiring the knowledge and skills we're trying to teach. I do think that today, the topic, there is a lot more awareness. I do think school systems try very hard to combat the problem. We do well, I think, with any type of interaction that occurs within the confinement of the building and during the course of the day, but we struggle to mitigate the effects that may occur on social media or online outside the school atmosphere. But that doesn't mean we don't try. It just means it's hard to sometimes prevent what goes on after the kids leave our buildings.
Talk about some of the positives. How are student test scores in Carnes City? Are you satisfied with the educational program there, Superintendent?
Well, I believe we have a good educational program, and I think that from year to year you always assess things. The preliminary data that is available to us for the 16-17 test year does show improvement over the prior year's standardized testing. I think our teachers and kids work extremely hard. Our system, I think, this year has and will show growth. What I mean by that is the year after year improvement has picked up, and that is a concerted effort of our staff as well as the kids. And I think what we need to try to do more of is make the connections for the kids so that they see what it is we're teaching is meaningful to what they need to learn, and motivating those kids to give us their best so that they can be successful in the future.
No, that's an excellent point. I heard someone, this was just a couple of weeks ago, it was on television, I forget, it was one of the cable news channels I was watching, but there was a survey out, and these things come out all the time, doom and gloom surveys, you know. A recent survey showed that not one in three high school students can name a single right that's guaranteed under the Bill of Rights. And then the commentator went on to say, what are they teaching in schools these days? I jumped up out of my chair. I can't imagine a single school district in the country that doesn't touch on the Bill of Rights. Now, if a student decides that they don't want to be motivated, they don't care, they don't want to learn anything about it, that's one thing. But you can't immediately blame the schools for not teaching this. That's absurd.
Well, I would agree. It's taught, and I would safely say, and I could probably go out on the limb, that probably all the schools in our local communities teach that in their history courses, if not in other content areas. I think it's sometimes too easy to lose perspective, and what I mean by that is, I was a student here, and I believe I received a wonderful education, and it afforded me opportunities that enabled me to acquire the job I have today. But kids today are a little different than kids when I was their age. For one, the amount and volume of information that they have available at their fingertips is just astounding to me. The access to the internet, to online searches, to all kinds of factual information that maybe you or I would have been required to have memorized and to repeat and sound like, well, we really learned something, is probably foreshadowed by the fact that these students today, by and large, probably have more information that they can instantaneously find without needing to commit to memory. And that's something that society has to come to grips with, is kids learn differently today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a lot more distractions as well. I don't know whether I would have made it through the high school year as much success as I did if I had a smartphone and a laptop, you know, to distract me. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I'm old enough that I didn't have those items either, and so I was able to get through. But you are right. They have access to a lot of things that can be good, and they could distract you. And part of our job is to help teach them to appropriately use the tools they have available so they can be successful.
We have a couple more minutes, listeners, that were able to chat with Mr. Eric Ritzer. It's been a lovely chat so far. We need to take a quick break here, just a quick one. And when we come back, I want to talk about extracurricular activities. Sports and other stuff, too. Garden City has one of the longest traditions of excellence in sports programs in our region. And I'll tell you a little story about that, Mr. Ritzer, when we come back. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR. Quick check of the lottery numbers this afternoon. We'll be right back.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 2424. The pick 3 is 306. The pick 4, 7168. The pick 5, 06764. Wild ball for each of those is 0. The treasure hunt is 2, 4, 5, 14, and 25. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000.
Every time. We're chuckling here, folks. We're back on the line with the superintendent, Eric Ritzert, from Carn City Area School District. I was just sharing with the superintendent a little anecdote about the sports history, the successful sports history of Carn City. I was talking with my late father once, Mr. Ritzert, and this is some years ago now. He was a pretty good basketball player. In fact, he was an outstanding basketball player. I was not, probably one of his biggest disappointments in me, I think. But I asked him once, he played for, this was before the state law which mandated consolidation of schools, which was, I think, in 1959, I'm not sure. He played for what was then Parker High School. It's now part of AC Valley. And I can remember asking him once, Dad, who are your toughest opponents a year in, year out? He said, oh, Garden City. He said, oh, they were always good. He said, they were always good. And they still are. Your sports program is outstanding, isn't it?
It is, and I think that's something the community is very proud of. And honestly, again, the kids, they work extremely hard. And I think the other component is when you hire coaches, you try to hire coaches that will stay with the program. And they carry on that tradition. And I would say over the years, there's been probably some teams that have overperformed expectations. And that's a credit to, I think, the adults that help coach those kids to make them successful. But we have a proud tradition, as you mentioned, of doing well in most of the sports that we participate in.
And wasn't it, it's a couple of years ago now, but was it your girls' basketball team or the girls' soccer team that went way into the state tournament, I believe? Just outstanding.
It was the girls' basketball team. I believe it was in 2001. They'd won the girls' state championship for AA.
Now, that's just an amazing accomplishment for what would be considered a medium-sized school. Carn City's not a gargantuan school district. To win the state championship for girls, pretty great. By the way, that's something else that was probably a little different when you went to school, certainly was when I went to school. Much more opportunity for girls in athletics now.
There are, I am a father of three girls. I have a newfound appreciation for that, but it is important that we do the same for the female athletes and students as we probably once did for the young men. And there are a lot more opportunities. I'm pleased to say that we promote with equity both girls and boys sports and fund and treat all programs as equal as they possibly can be.
Well, seems to me, and my evidence is anecdotal, but there's always a Carn City team that's gone far in the playoffs, whether it's girls' soccer, girls' basketball, football team, whatever. What about other extracurricular activities, art and music education? Are you satisfied with what you're doing there, Superintendent Richard?
I am. We've, even through some of the economic challenges of the last, say, 5 years, we've not reduced or cut the extracurricular activities. We've tried to maintain that for our kids. We believe that the school is sort of the hub for the community. We partner with the churches and work well together, but we want to make sure our kids have an opportunity to not only learn but also enjoy their experience while they're students here.
And a lot of those areas, those are lifelong good habits to develop, whether it's music or art appreciation or whatever. Sure, algebra and literature is important, but you're not going to, most of us at least, are not going to run into too many quadratic equations when we, get into adulthood. But an appreciation of music or plays or art, very important.
Very important. We're fortunate to have some of the best artistic people around on staff, and at the risk of probably missing some people, but I would give a shout out to Beth Ackleson, who runs a tremendous drama program, and we have some of the best musicals of any of the schools in the county.
Our guest has been Superintendent Eric Ritzert. He is the superintendent of schools in the Carn City Area School District. Sir, thanks very much. I know the daily life of a school superintendent is busy, busy, busy. Thanks for sharing some information with us here for a few minutes today.
Well, thank you. I greatly appreciate it.
Sure, sure. So long now, sir.
Okay, goodbye.
Superintendent Eric Ritzert. I've not talked to him before. Nice man. Nice man. Carn City. Carn City School District. We'll continue our visits. In fact, I think it's tomorrow, right? We're talking with the superintendent of Seneca Valley. I'm not going to do this every day, but over the next few weeks, we'll cover top administrators in all of our regional school districts. Seneca Valley, one of the biggest. Seneca Valley and Butler and Mars are the three biggest school districts now. What else do we have coming up on tomorrow's program? We've got the Butler Little Theater Group here. They are, gosh, it's time to open a new season for all of our cultural groups. The Suck Up Theater opened up for the new season with their ballet performance last weekend. The Butler Little Theater is going to be opening up a new season this weekend, and it's a Neil Simon show. Tough to beat Neil Simon. He's the guy that wrote The Odd Couple. Biloxi Blues is the show that opens this weekend on the BLT stage. We'll have some members of the staff with us tomorrow. Also, a gathering of authors, talking about local authors from the region, not just Butler County, but from western Pennsylvania. We'll meet some of them, tell you about a gathering of authors coming up tomorrow. And